You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a Swiss civil court has found Nestlé guilty of spying on an NGO. We'll ask how common this type of corporate espionage is. Then we'll be looking at why Hamas is taking Hebrew lessons when we check in with our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana.
The fact that Hamas is teaching its pupils Hebrew demonstrates exactly how far the Gaza Strip has been separated, not only from Israel, but also from the West Bank. And it also demonstrates exactly how important the Hebrew language is to understanding Israel and Palestine.
We'll speak with our man in Madrid about an unfolding corruption scandal that El País believes stretches all the way to the Prime Minister's bank account. And there'll be all the fun of the fair as we visit the Nuremberg Toy Fair. All that plus music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. A very busy hour ahead of us then, but before we get stuck in, let's get the latest news from around the world with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Syria has formally complained to the United Nations over a reported Israeli attack within its borders. Syria's army says Israeli jets targeted a military research centre northwest of Damascus on Wednesday, killing two people and wounding five. It's denied reports that lorries carrying weapons bound for Lebanon were hit. Russia has called the attack unacceptable, and Turkey is warning of repercussions. Hisham Marwa from the Syrian National Coalition, the opposition group exiled in Turkey, says Israel has breached international law.
We believe what Israeli did, it's illegal, because, you know, it is using, the sky of other country, which is illegal according to international community law. So it is not be accepted anyhow. But sorry to say, Bashar doesn't care about that this time. His aim these days just to stop the revolution there, to kill his people, not to protect his land or his sky.
United Nations human rights investigators have called on Israel to halt settlement expansion and withdraw all Jewish settlers from the West Bank. The report by the UN's Human Rights Council says the settlements violate international law and Palestinian human rights. It says Palestinians are displaced by the settlements, their crops and property are destroyed, and they're subjected to violence. Israel has refused to cooperate with the inquiry, and its foreign ministry has accused the council of being systematically biased against Israel. French judge Christine Chanet, who led the team of investigators, says the settlements contravene the 1949 Geneva Convention.
To build a state, you need a land, and if you look at the map, you have a map in the annex of the report, you will see how the settlements are breaking the continuity of Palestinian land. So that's why we are pointing out that it's a kind of creeping annexation.
France's defense minister says 3 weeks of French airstrikes in northern Mali have left Islamist militants in disarray. Jean-Yves Le Drian says the militants have now scattered, marking a turning point in France's intervention. His comments come as the French troops continue to secure Kidal, the last town occupied by militants. France is preparing to hand over towns it's captured to an African force, which is now being deployed into Mali. The European Court of Justice in Luxembourg has ruled that the Irish budget airline Ryanair broke European Union law by refusing to pay out cash to a customer left stranded in Portugal by the Icelandic volcanic ash cloud 3 years ago. Whilst Denise McDonough was waiting to fly back to Dublin from Faro on April the 17th, 2010, she ran up hotel, meal and refreshment bills of €1,130 and sent them to the airline. But Ryanair refused to reimburse her, claiming the consequences of the eruption were so unexpected they could not count as extraordinary circumstances. The courts ordered Ryanair to cover the costs she incurred. The decision could have an impact on prices in the budget airline market. A 100-year-old British man is celebrating his 86th year of employment. Office administrator Jim Clements returned to work at the age of 66 after a spell of retirement and has been with the same company ever since. He was initially employed on a temporary contract for a period of 1 month. Jim's now in his 34th year, working 2 days a week with a security company based in Harlow in Essex. He explains he was fed up with retirement.
I got so bored at home, the wife said, for God's sake, go out and get a little job. So she was looking in the paper, and this was advertised. I got in the car and came up. They interviewed me and said, yes, we'll take you on a month's trial. I said, but I was going on holiday. That's quite a rope, wait, come back. So when I came back and came up, and I've been here ever since.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. It's just ticking towards 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards. Now, a Swiss court has ruled against Nestlé in a long-running dispute about whether the company spied on an NGO. The story started back in 2003 when a TV programme accused Nestlé of infiltrating the Swiss attack organisation, even attending meetings in members' homes. While the compensation of €2,400 given to each claimant means nothing for the multinational, Kit Kat maker Nestlé has still been irked, especially as in recent years the business has worked hard to repair its reputation after a series of run-ins with NGOs over the selling of baby formula in Africa. But how common is this sort of tactic in the business world? Well, I'm joined in the studio by Sophie Grove, the host of Monocle's The Entrepreneurs, and on the line from the US by J.D. Lejeune, director of the Espionage Research Institute International. J.D., thanks very much for joining us on Midori House. I wanted to start just by asking you, how common is this sort of espionage practice, if you like? Are we used to seeing it in the kind of businesses like Nestlé?
Yes, absolutely. First, thank you also for having me on your program. It's a pleasure. And the United States, because of globalization and competition, have led to increased corporate espionage targeting the U.S. and its allies. And no one really knows how large the problem truly is. But our own FBI here, their investigations involving the intelligence services of at least 23 countries, half of them unfriendly states, and the rest friends and close allies. It's very, very difficult to ascertain at this point just how widespread the problem is. But just in the late 90s alone, the National Counterintelligence Agency here suggests that U.S. businesses have lost in excess of $44 billion over that period of time.
Now, J.D., I mean, these are some fairly staggering sums you mention, but I wonder, to a layman like myself, it seems almost archaic to have people actually trying to infiltrate institutions, to actually physically get in there, presumably to eavesdrop and spy. We're used in this era to hearing about cyber espionage, cyber crime. How common is this sort of thing, this very, observational, actually trying to infiltrate organisations? That's surely something from the past, isn't it?
Well, not really. I mean, many times the thing that a lot of corporations don't pay attention to is the fact that all of that information, all of their trade secret information, intellectual property, it all exists in the physical realm before it ever enters the cyber realm. So protecting it in the physical realm and having security protocols in place to protect those assets is very, very important indeed before it even enters the cyber realm.
So Sophie, if I can ask you next, I mean, we've spoken before about Nestlé and the problems they've had in terms of public relations. They obviously had this real problem with milk powder products that they were sort of foisting on communities where they did so much terrible damage. Do you think this is probably behind this? Nestlé were actually trying to if you like, get ahead of their bad press, find out what these NGOs and groups were sort of lobbying about, were trying to find out about them, to almost cut out the problems before they'd happened. Is it a legacy, do you think, of that those kind of instances?
Possibly. I mean, if I was a Nestle CEO, you know, you could understand the thinking here, but this type of sort of a revelation is so bad for the Nestle brand. They're already synonymous with being mean, with being aggressive, with really putting their profits in front of anything else. I mean, the Nestle boycott began in 1977, but it really took off in the 80s, and it's still rumbling on now. I mean, even you know, as in 2011, in Asia Pacific Forum, they were talking about Nestle. Were they labelling products correctly for baby milk formula in Laos? Have they been sort of, you know, following the code of conduct for the, you know, that's been placed down by the WHO? And so many times these NGOs are coming out and saying actually they're falling short of the rules still. And you wonder, you know, it just is. It is bad for the brand, and the boycott still lingers. So something like this is very damning.
And I wonder, JD, it's an interesting point that Sophie makes there about, you know, the upper echelons of these companies having to take an interest. In your experience, is this sort of espionage, industrial espionage, as we term it, is this organised from then the boardroom level? Is this the biggest chiefs, if you like, around their boardroom table actually planning things out? Or are there these shady sub-departments of these big corporations where they actually strike through the kind of deals that are going to be done that involve this sort of subterfuge?
Well, it's been our experience that there is always in place what we refer to as a cutout, which will insulate those higher echelon, C-suite level corporate executives from being involved in this type of thing. And corporate espionage, although it can take on many forms, from theft to physical assets to sabotage, it's most often associated with, you know, the theft of intellectual property or information. Call it espionage or competitive intelligence. The fact is that individuals are still illegally acquiring sensitive, restricted information, assets of another entity, which may include all types of intellectual property, being product designs, business models, marketing plans, research and development, customer lists, pricing information, and you know, that corporate spying does not just occur between businesses. Corporations spy on individuals, political groups, special interest groups, and even citizen groups. So it's a very widespread problem still to this day.
It's pretty grave. You're making me slightly paranoid, JD. Sophie, if I can just finish by asking you then, you obviously, with, you know, through the entrepreneurs and on the magazine, you look at a lot of ethical businesses, very well run, where good practice is everything. I mean, with your business hat on, would you have any advice then for the likes of Nestle? Should they just seek to admit that this is a lost cause, try and turn over a new leaf? What's the business strategy for them?
I think that they have to come clean at some point and, you know, develop a systematic sort of culture in Nestle of transparency, because they've lost the trust of so many people. And, you know, there are so many people that are suspicious of their practices. They need to streamline the business. And, you know, so many of the reports that I've been reading about Nestle, you know, they have these agents. And whether it's in the developing world or whether it's in Britain, there are people that are working for Nestle pushing the formula, so states, you know, a number of reports anyway. Maybe they need to rein things in and make sure that they have a core Nestle group of people that have been anointed by them, rather than having this kind of these tentacles out there that can so easily go awry.
Well, I wonder whether we've heard the last. But for now, JD Lejeune, Director of the Espionage Research Institute International, and our very own Sophie Grove, thanks for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be looking at some surprising language lessons in the Middle East.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is, it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on Monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, given the fraught relationship between the Arab and Jewish residents of Israel and Palestine, it seems curious that when it comes to choosing a second language to learn, many Arab residents take up Hebrew. And now the Islamist party Hamas has announced its plans to expand Hebrew language courses in Gaza Strip high schools. To talk about whether this is a nod to the old maxim, know thy enemy, or an attempt to foster dialogue between two foes, we're joined on the line from Ramallah by Monocle's correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, thanks as always for joining us on Midori House. As somebody who knows these areas and the various players in this saga so well, are you surprised by this move from Hamas?
I'm actually not terribly surprised. And one of the reasons why I'm not that surprised is that Hamas and Israel, for that matter, has really succeeded in kind of separating the Gaza Strip from Israel and from the West Bank. And so the fact that Hamas has announced that it's going to teach children in primary schools, in high schools, Hebrew, is really a demonstration that they feel as though Hebrew is a language of great importance, whether it be understanding the political media, whether it be understanding cryptic messages from the Israelis, or whether it be even communicating with some Palestinians in the West Bank, and they feel separated from that, and so they're you know, pushing through a new educational platform, which will see, you know, greater kind of Hebrew education and immersion.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that thing there. I wonder about that aspect of it. Are we wrong to suspect that there's some kind of insidious thing here where, you know thy enemy, you know, to be able to understand, intercept messages? Or is this actually, to some degree at least, you know, a good news story, something about a unifying quality, a unifying project that could actually bring people together somewhat?
Well, it very much is a unifying project. I wouldn't say it's with the best intentions. The fact of the matter is that the Israelis very much control the borders of Gaza, what goes in and out. They control, or they have, the West Bank under a military occupation. And so the language that they're speaking in, the language that they're communicating in, is of utmost importance. Now, Hamas, the media that's been picking up on this story, has said a number of very unsavory statements about knowing the language of the enemy and interpreting the evil of the enemy. And this is very much what Hamas often does. But they've also mentioned this fact that they want to read Israeli newspapers, that they want to understand exactly the political thinking that's going on inside of Israel. And so that really is the practical dimension of teaching their children how to speak Hebrew.
And Joseph, what about the boot on the other foot, if you like, then? Are a lot of Israelis learning to speak Arabic, or more than we might anticipate? Has that been your personal experience? And what about on a sort of state level?
Well, Arabic is an official language of Israel. During the last Knesset, there was actually a very controversial bill that came up. It was brought down. It didn't go through to actual law, but it basically argued that Arabic should be removed from one of the official languages in order to kind of shore up Hebrew as the one and only official language, thus, you know, demonstrating the Jewish character of the state of Israel. Now, a lot of Israelis kind of, they understand a little bit of Arabic. You know, I'm coming from the United States, and a lot of Americans kind of understand a little bit of Spanish. That's a lot, you know, that's kind of how I feel in speaking with Israelis about Arabic. And there's also a number of Israelis that come from Arab countries. They're known as Mizrahi Jews, and they speak fluent Arabic. And so Arabic is not a strange language in Israeli society, even though it is becoming more kind of controversial as Israelis really kind of determine the nature, the kind of character of their state.
And I just wondered on a personal level, Joseph, do you find that you sort of switch between, you know, all of your various tongues when you're in these places according to where you are and who you're talking to? How does it work when you're, say, traveling around in the West Bank, for example?
It's actually very interesting. In the West Bank, a lot of Palestinians speak Hebrew. They've gotten Hebrew from working inside of Israel or even being in Israeli jails, which the numbers are incredibly high among Palestinians. And so I found myself in situations in a taxi, for example, lost with a taxi driver, him not really speaking English that well, my Arabic not really getting us to the destination, but both of us having a somewhat good, you know, command of Hebrew, and then having the conversation in Hebrew and arriving at the destination. And so stepping back from these situations, it's incredibly, you know, bizarre based on how we kind of look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that here it is, this American journalist in the middle of the West Bank, in a Palestinian taxi, having a conversation in Hebrew about how to arrive at the destination. And so it does really go to show you kind of how, you know, intermixed the various languages, whether it be Arabic, English, or Hebrew, really are on the ground, and how easy it is to kind of, you know, move back and forth into these various language environments.
Joseph Dana in Ramallah, thanks so much for joining us on Midori House to tell us all about Hamas's experiment with Hebrew. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be heading to Spain to discover why the Prime Minister is being accused of corruption. Now, only yesterday, the Spanish government was debating corruption. Today, a leading paper published a story accusing Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy and other leading members of the ruling Conservative Popular Party of receiving secret off-the-books payments. Rajoy's office has denied that the Prime Minister was given money from a slush fund. But it comes at a tricky moment for the embattled Prime Minister as he attempts to bring the country's economy back to life, while also persuading Spanish people to pay higher taxes. A protest at the front of the PP headquarters has been called for later this evening. To explain more about this story, we're joined on the line now by our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous. Liam, thanks for joining us on Midori House. So tell me, how upset are people getting in Spain about this?
They're quite upset, I have to say. There's been outrage today. If it's worth mentioning, Twitter in Spain actually collapsed today, apparently because everyone was so outraged with the scandal. But it does come after a long line of corruption scandals with government MPs, mayors, even celebrities in Spain. So people are just shaking their heads, but they're not surprised.
And what does the media make of all this then? Because there are quite a few sensational stories about, you know, corruption at all levels. We have various stories about the president, the royal family, even a few pop stars, I gather, embroiled in corruption. Is this, do you think, a necessary consequence of all of the financial woes the country has suffered the last few years? Or is there something else at play here?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I think it is definitely a consequence of the construction boom that Spain is. The economy is suffering from the end of the construction boom, but now all this corruption seems to be quite linked to the construction boom as well, where a lot of construction firms were paying bonuses to politicians. A lot of the politicians were involved in kind of setting up these deals. So the fact that all this has come to light now, that all these slush funds existed and these big envelopes of cash were kind of passed around in the government offices, is just another consequence of the boom times. And now it's all coming to a head, but it's all coming to public attention a little too late. And there's a lot of people implicated, like you said, with the president or the prime minister, whatever you want to call him, because he's called the president here in Spain. He's implicated, but he is actually nowhere to be seen. He actually sent his the secretary general of the PP party out today to fend off the questions. But as usual, the Spanish prime minister is missing in action.
Now, Liam, I want to ask you a little bit more detail about some of these payments then, because I gather that some of them are described in fairly sort of lurid terms, but others it's more prosaic. A lot of them listed as money for, you know, ties, money for suits. I wondered, well, that might come as a surprise to some people, given that Mariano Rajoy, not perhaps most celebrated for his look.
No, he's actually never appeared in our style leader series in Monaco, has he? But some of the payments for tires, something like 8,000 or 10,000 euros just for tires each month. He must have a lot of tires, but that's what's really called these payments into question. But they've vigorously denied that these payments were illegal and that they even exist. And they did. There were a few days ago saying that some of the money was for food allowances, and it was all on the books and it was all completely legal. But it was actually these payments. These records show that Rajoy was receiving about 25,000 euros a year, which actually over 11 years, it's about 270,000 euros. It's a lot of money, and when you consider the fact that the man who kind of started all this is the ex-treasurer of the PP, Luis Barcenas, has a Swiss bank account, with worth 22 million euros. Everyone's quite outraged, especially when you consider the fact that it's a time of massive austerity measures in Spain. So when the whole population is suffering and it's the ruling party seem to be handing out stuffed envelopes of cash in the head office, people aren't happy.
And just finally, Liam, very briefly, you've been explaining that we're going to see some protests perhaps this evening. There might even be calls for new elections. What do you think in the short term and long term, will these protests turn ugly, and will we see more elections, do you think?
I don't think we're going to see elections. I think the government is just going to keep denying the existence of this unless there's irrefutable proof that these documents are actually real. But the people will protest. The fact that the protests since last December have been getting uglier and uglier just because the police have been taking a harder line and the people have also been attacking the police as well. So it's kind of like a bit of a powder keg. So people will take to the streets. But when this news story broke about a week and a half ago, that the Luis Barcenas story broke, people did actually protest in front of the PP headquarters, but there weren't many people there. So it's going to be interesting to see how many people go out tonight when there's some real proof that's been published in the papers. So we'll see what happens. We'll have to follow this story closely.
Liam, thanks very much for joining us. That's Monocle's Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous. Time now for some music, and we've just been in Madrid. Let's keep it there with a suitably Spanish song and hear from Jarabe de Palo. This is Bonito.
Bonito, todo me parece bonito. Que vive el presente, bonita la gente que estuvo y no está bonito. Todo me parece bonito.
That was Jarabe de Palo with Bonito. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, coming up in the next half hour of Midori House, we're going to look at Qatari investment in London and check in at the world's biggest toy festival in Bavaria. But before all that excitement, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Syria has formally complained to the United Nations over a reported Israeli attack within its borders. Syria's army says Israeli jets targeted a military research centre northwest of Damascus on Wednesday, killing two people and wounding five. It's denied reports that lorries carrying weapons bound for Lebanon were hit. Russia has called the attack unacceptable and Turkey's warning of repercussions. United Nations human rights investigators have called on Israel to halt settlement expansion and withdraw all Jewish settlers from the West Bank. The report by the UN's Human Rights Council says the settlements violate international law and Palestinian human rights. Israel has refused to cooperate with the inquiry, and its foreign ministry has accused the council of being systematically biased against Israel. France's defence minister says 3 weeks of French airstrikes in northern Mali have left Islamist militants in disarray. Jean-Yves Le Drian says the militants have now scattered, marking a turning point in France's intervention. His comments come as the French troops continue to secure Kidal, the last town occupied by militants. The European Court of Justice in Luxembourg has ruled that the Irish budget airline Ryanair broke European Union law by refusing to pay out cash to a customer left stranded in Portugal by the Icelandic volcanic ash cloud 3 years ago. Whilst Denise McDonough was waiting to fly back to Dublin from Faro in April 2010, she ran up hotel, meal and refreshment bills of €1,130 and sent them to the airline. The courts ordered Ryanair to cover the costs she incurred, The decision could have an impact on prices in the budget airline market. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, we're turning next to a controversial construction project rather closer to home, at least to Monocle 24's home here in London. It's emerged that Qatar's QatariDR, its construction arm, has placed its plans to redevelop the famous Chelsea Barracks site in the city on hold amid concerns at the health of the UK economy. The local council are concerned by the delays, but opponents of the redevelopment of the plot, sold to Qatar by the Ministry of Defence for almost £1 billion 6 years ago, are delighted. So what does this decision mean for the high-profile £3 billion development? Is this further evidence that some of the jostling for London landmarks by buyers from sovereign wealth funds might have hit the buffers? Or is it emblematic of the unique problems that this particular site has posed, with everyone from Prince Charles to the great architect Lord Rogers queuing up to have their say? Well, joining me on the line now is Neil Callanan, a real estate reporter at Bloomberg News. Neil, thanks for joining us on Midori House. So just give me a rough idea. What would you say about the general state of Qatari investment in terms of London property? Is it still in pretty robust health?
Hi. Yes, it's still in robust health. They've had a fairly clear policy of buying up either luxury sites or buying showy office buildings. They seem to like making statements in terms of either location or with the building, and you can see that now with the Shard, which dominates London's skyline. They own 95% of that and the neighbouring building, The Place, but still no tenants announced, still no leases agreed apparently on the office space. But they have a very, very long timeline in terms of how they invest, and they seem able to afford to take that risk and eventually believing that they'll get returns to justify it.
Now, Neil, I was talking to somebody earlier on, and they characterised a lot of this sovereign wealth fund investment and similar as almost being like a game of chess played out on the streets of London with sort of marquee buildings. The Shard, as you mentioned there, very, very striking, very arresting project, but the utility questionable given, as you say, it's yet to find people to lease its space. Do you think there's a sense that perhaps the desire to build these marquee projects, to buy these famous London landmarks, almost gets ahead of good business sense?
Well, the thing about sovereign wealth funds is that they invest on up to a 40-year timeline. So while a normal property company or a private equity fund would never necessarily develop these projects because they can't justify the returns over the period that they would invest in, sovereign wealth funds take a different position, believing that the market would come back. And in relation to the Shard, the Qataris were relatively laissez-faire at the launch of the building. When they were asked when they expected to make a return back, they just said eventually. They seemed nonplussed about it. For them as well, it's a statement of international. It's putting their country on the map internationally through projects like this. And so some of it's about national status as opposed to underlying investment rationale.
And Neil, in terms of this particular project, without getting into the specifics, of course, it is interesting, of course, that they're choosing, you know, to at least pause with their initial planned development. Do you think this probably is just to do with a reservation about short-term health of the British economy, or do you think there's a more deep-seated concern underlying this decision?
Yeah, we asked Great Portland today, who have been approached by a number of developers trying to buy buildings for conversion to luxury residential, whether they had seen any drop in the number of potential buyers, and they said quite the opposite. So this seems somewhat linked to the project itself and the difficulties that have dogged it since for the entirety of its history. But having said that, you would also have to look at Rightmove. Said this month that prices went down in Kensington and Chelsea more than any other borough in London last month. And whether there's a continued huge appetite from overseas investors, because they're the ones driving up residential prices, remains to be seen this year, particularly if some of the political events in the Middle East, which has driven this investment, if peace breaks out, as it were.
And just finally, Neil, on this specific site, it has been very divisive amongst the local community. People have been queuing up. Prince Charles stuck his oar in. Lord Rogers had something to say. What do you think it is about this particular site that seems to have got people so agitated?
Even the partners fought with each other because CPC Group, which was Christian Candy, and the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund ended up in court with each other about it as well. I think it's a very difficult site with very, very strong local residents, and I think there was signals for the last 6 to 8 months that the Qataris were wondering themselves what to do with it. They announced they were going to build a Harrods Hotel on the site, and then they sold land just south of it to another sovereign wealth fund and a company called London and Stamford. I think they're aware that this is a site that's drawn a lot of protests, and they're conscious of their effect on communities. They might be keeping their heads down and wondering whether there's a better use for the land in the longer term.
Neil Callanan, a real estate reporter at Bloomberg, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at the Japanese film industry.
Ever since Monocle launched in 2007, we've championed a roll your sleeves up, put on your overalls attitude to problems and possibilities. The how-to section in our February issue catches up with business owners, innovators and cultural figures creating new ways to work. And the list is an eclectic mix.
A group of frontline do-gooders.
Chilean entrepreneurs going out on a limb for olive oil.
Nashville-based singer-songwriter Caitlin Rose.
Ceramic makers injecting life into San Francisco's city centre with a new manufacturing hub.
And we head to the Maldives to meet the entrepreneur who set up a one-man airline.
To learn from the experts how to make, do or mend your business or your ambition, watch our how-to slideshow on monocle.com.
The Menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition we find out about the merits of urban beekeeping in Berlin. We visit an area of Seoul that has shaken its criminal reputation to become a hotspot for international restaurants. And we talk about a new trend which has people pairing their hot dogs with a glass of champagne.
Champagne goes very well with fatty food because the acidity of champagne cuts through the fat content and it's extremely satisfying.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be heading to Japan next, and to take us there, let's hear Red and Blue by the Jill Decoy Association.
Tonight, let's go back to the days when we...
That was Red and Blue by the Jill Decoy Association. Now, in 2012, the Japanese film industry recorded its best year at the box office since 2000. Locally made movies grossed more than $1 billion, representing an increase of more than 25% from the previous year. The figures give hope to the Japanese film industry that has otherwise been suffering, like so many other sectors, following the trials and tribulations of the last year. But with more popular Japanese films being made, and more importantly, seen, could we expect more interest from Western moviegoers? Well, a little earlier, our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé spoke to Kenji Hall in our Tokyo bureau.
What's happened at the box office, do you think? Is it just a new generation of directors? Is it a different style of marketing? What's going on?
No, in fact, I think it's the opposite. If you look at the top three box office films, two of them were actually series. The top one was Braveheart's Umizaru 4, which is the fourth in the series about the Japan Coast Guard. And we can go off on a tangent about all why this film on the Japan Coast Guard has sort of topped the box office charts, but it has, and it has historically as well. So I think the thing that can be said about this is that we've seen a rebound in leisure spending since the disaster in 2011. And I think that's a big reason why you're seeing a rebound in box office ticket sales. The other thing is that, interestingly enough, if you look at the top grossing foreign films, they tend to be the big blockbuster type, Mission Impossible, James Bond, The Avengers. It's not the indies. It's not the ones that necessarily get a lot of headlines, you know, at the Oscars, at the Golden Globes. So the big sort of blockbusters still get top billing here in Japan.
Mm. I want to go back to the Umisar, the Sea Monkey Coast Guard series, and I've mostly consumed them, you know, flying back and forth on ANA. They're a very particular genre. They remind you almost of, in a way, war films, things that, you know, would have probably come out, you know, in the early sort of 1950s. There's a very sort of naive storyline, very heroic. But, you know, is part of this also somewhat tethered to a certain type of nationalism that's going on as well in Japan?
Oh, absolutely. Just like you said, this one, Umizari 4, is about the rescue of an airplane that goes down in the ocean. It's very, very predictable storyline. The Coast Guard goes in. They try to rescue everyone. There's a lot of tension between the characters. It's that, you know, should they sacrifice their own people in order to save some of the passengers? It does coincide with the huge number of applicants, actually, in this past year for the Japan Coast Guard. They had doubled the previous year. Also, as you mentioned, the Japan Coast Guard is getting a lot of press because its budget is going up and it's creating a team of hundreds of its recruits and also adding to a fleet of new patrol boats to guard the Senkaku Islands, which the Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands. That territorial row with China is definitely adding to all of this sort of promotional stuff that's playing in the Coast Guard's favor.
So aside from just crashing through the waves and trying to rescue aircraft, what are sort of the genres of other types of films, homegrown films that have done well?
Okay, so obviously the anime do really well. One Piece film, Z, was one of the top-ranked films of the year. There is a film, and you're going to get a kick out of this one. It's called Terumae no Mae, and it's the story of ancient Rome and a modern-day Japanese bathhouse.
Oh, I've seen that. I mean, that's a huge manga series, which is now has been made into a proper series or film in that sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then number three was Odoru Dai Soul Seppen, which is Bayside Shakedown, which is a police action comedy, another series. The thing that I want to point out here is that all three of these films were distributed by Toho, in part by Toho or entirely by Toho. Toho has 600 cinemas across Japan. That's about 20% of all the cinemas in Japan. So when you have that kind of distribution power behind you or behind your film, you're bound to do pretty well.
That was Kenji Hall in Tokyo talking to Tyler Brûlé a little earlier. Now we'll be talking toys in just a few minutes, but to get us in the playful spirit, let's hear Time Bomb by Kylie. That was, of course, Time Bomb by Kylie. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, yesterday marked the beginning of the 63rd annual Spielwarenmesse International Toy Fair, the world's biggest. Over 5 days, more than 2,500 exhibitors from 62 countries will show off their newest products. And 76,000 visitors from 120 countries are expected to flock to Nuremberg to attend the event. We're joined today by the marketing director of Spielwarenmesse International Toy Fair Nuremberg, Christian Ulrich. Hello, Herr Ulrich. Thanks very much for joining us on Midori House. I'd just like to start by asking you, what are you most excited about the fair this year?
Well, of course, we have one topic which is our focus topic. It's called Toys 3.0, and it's a quite new generation of toys working with apps, with smartphones, with tablets, which is a really brand new topic, and I think this segment will be growing quite a lot during the next years.
So, but tell me, is there still space for a lot of the traditional favourites, you know, the maybe more old-fashioned toys people might think, to go alongside and work with these apps? It's not all new technology, is it?
Yeah, there's still a space for the old or traditional toys like good old puzzles and board games and so on. But sometimes it's just a combination of these traditional toys with some of these more technical gadgets. For example, if you have a board game and you don't use a traditional board anymore, but maybe a tablet, you place your figures on the tablet, on the screen, and then you have some additional functions, for example, a new situation that you couldn't have, of course, with a board, which is static, and you have more interaction with these kind of games.
Now, tell me, Christian, I gather that over 1 million products are displayed at the fair. Now, be honest with me. Do you get to go and have a look at all of them?
No, that's not possible. We made a calculation, and if you want to see all these products in the 6 days the fair is running, I think you have 0.1 second for each product, which is impossible. So I think most of our visitors are concentrating on the new product. We estimate that we have about 70,000 new products, which is still quite a lot.
And so what's your advice then for people who want to tackle the best bits of the fair? If they don't just want to see the new stuff, if they still also like the more traditional ones, is there a way that they can be sure that they don't miss out on any of the real highlights?
We have a segmentation with a product group. So each hall has a special product group. For example, there's one hall concentrating on all these wooden toys, for example, or for babies. And we have a special award, which is called the Toy Award. Actually, there are 5 awards for different kind of age categories. And there you find totally different toys, from wooden toys to even these electronical toys like Toys 3.0.
And Christian, when are the sort of big winners named then of these categories? Does that take place right at the start yesterday, or have we got that still to look forward to?
No, that was actually the day before yesterday in our opening ceremony, and there we had the 5 winners of these 5 categories.
Now, tell me, you mentioned before about these new technologies and how that's influencing the market. Are there any other trends? What if you had to sort of look into your crystal ball and tell us what we might be talking about in a year's time? What do you think the big developments, the big exciting themes will be in the world of toys in the next 12 months?
There's a totally different trend like these Toys 3.0. It's more about, let's call it creative lifestyle. So a lot of do-it-yourself products, like you can do your rings, for example, or necklaces by yourself with a kind of modular system. Or even if you have some kind of plush toys that you can color yourself and you can put some jewels on it. Yeah, you put it in the washing machine and it comes out clean and you can try it again. And very nice toys, which I like very much, about storytelling. So it's like the traditional dice, but you have some kind of symbols on it, and the children have to combine these symbols and make a kind of story out of it. And I think these toys, they're very helpful for the fantasy of the children. They are quite simple, and I think these toys will still exist in 10 or 20 years, maybe besides other toys like working with tablets or apps.
Christian Ulrich, Director of Marketing of Spielwarenmesse International Toy Fair Nuremberg. Thanks very much for joining us to give us that update on the world's biggest toy fair. Well, I'm sorry to say that's all we have time for today. Thanks go to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course, our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Coming up next on Monocle 24 is The Urbanist, where we take a look at the material that makes up the foundations of our cities, cement, including a chat with expert Dr. Adrian Forty, who'll tell us who uses it and what for. But in 3 hours' time, we'll have the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Steve Bloomfield and Andrew Muller will be back for that. Tyler Brule will be bringing you Midori House at the same time tomorrow. I've been Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.